Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. I'm in Louisville, Kentucky. You're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com or Rational Radio 1360 AM, Dallas, Texas. Today, we have a great show as usual, but I want to talk a little bit about what we're doing. Of course, I'm in Louisville, and I'm talking about my book, Miss America. I'm in the middle of writing the 20 greatest myths of the robber class and the case for revolution, and that book should be out soon. But I'm also formulating something that's very exciting. It's called the International People's Declaration of Peace. I think we need a grassroots movement to reach across borders, to get to know each other, to make sure that we don't join our governments in killing other people's children or having our own children killed by the government. So if you want to read the International People's Declaration of Peace, you can find it at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox Blogspot.com. That's Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox Blogspot.com. After the break, we'll be talking to unembedded journalist, my friend, Dar Jamail.
Cindy Sheehan's new booklet, Myth America, examines two distinct groups of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims, such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet, those who send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose their jobs and homes and become homeless. Myth America exposes America's robber class, which controls our government, and affirms that we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. To obtain a copy of Myth America and learn how we can take back our country, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Our first guest, Dar Jamail, is an award-winning, unembedded journalist who tells the hidden story of American soldiers turning against military occupation in his new book, The Will to Resist. Dar, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Good to be with you, Cindy.
Oh, it's great to be with you. Full disclosure, Dar is a friend of mine, and he's one of my heroes, and I've just been so impressed with everything he's done since before the war in Iraq started. So, Dar, it's quite an honor to have you on my show.
Well, thank you, Cindy, and full disclosure, ditto on my end.
It's a mutual admiration society. So, you know, many people voted for Barack Obama. I fully believe that the Democratic base in this country is anti-war. They want the wars in Iraq over, a war in Afghanistan over. They want the troops to start coming home. That actually, you know, in reality hasn't happened. And this week has been, there's been a lot of stuff coming out of Iraq. You know, the people in the government in Iraq are afraid that Maliki is trying to turn into a quasi-dictator. He's ousting some people from the Interior Ministry, which has been very corrupt. That's people that I know in Iraq tell me the Interior Ministry is awful. There were 25 Iraqis killed in northern Iraq near Mosul the other day. It seems like things are really heating up in the Kurdish areas. And yesterday, 44 Iraqis were killed and 61 were wounded in another Kurdish village. And we had 4 U.S. soldiers killed, not yesterday, but the day before. And there was a report that came out that said the U.S. is going to be taking troops out, but they're going to be replacing them with mercenaries, more than 2-to-1, in a 2-to-1 ratio, and mercenaries coming from Uganda or Kenya. Dar, what do you, I know you have a lot of good contacts there, and I know you've been there a lot. What's your analysis of what's happening in Iraq?
Well, for starters, Maliki is not a quasi-dictator. I mean, he already is. He's basically the new Shia Saddam. I mean, there's no question about it. This is a guy that the U.S. put into power. They're maintaining him there, and, you know, largely through the intelligence services and the Mukhabarat and the Ministry of Interior. I mean, that's how this guy is staying in power. Saddam knew that the glue of his power resided in the intelligence services, and the U.S. has helped Maliki do the same thing. I mean, you know, let's remember that this is a guy, there was no democratic process involved in him becoming prime minister. He was basically inserted to replace Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari because Condoleezza Rice wanted him there, you know, at the beckoning of George W. Bush. So there's that, and then we look at the overall situation. Violence is not slowing down. Last month was the single bloodiest month for Iraqi civilians in over a year's time. We are starting to see more and more attacks on U.S. forces. We still have over 131,000 U.S. military personnel there. That number is not decreasing. The generals in charge of the situation are saying that that number will actually will have well over 100,000 troops in Iraq until at least the halfway through next year. So it's a dire situation. And when I was there earlier this year, there was a car bomb in Baghdad just about every day that I was there for the month that I was there. We're looking at a situation where the country overall has become extremely Balkanized, where literally going from one neighborhood to another is almost like going to a different country. You basically had to embed with a militia to get wherever you wanted to go. So it's a dire situation, and it's far, far, far from over, and we're looking at a situation where I think in the coming months we should expect it to get worse, unfortunately.
And unfortunately, when we say expect it to get worse, most Americans equate that with U.S. deaths. So there's one aspect that has been fortunate for U.S. soldiers is those amounts of deaths have been going down. So Iraq has practically disappeared off the radar screen of our media and of public consciousness. One of my friends was in Washington, D.C. on March 19th for the 6th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, and he was passing out flyers, and one woman told him, "Why are you doing this? The Iraq war is over. Obama's president."
Right, and you know, it's amazing, Cindy, as you know all too well, probably better than anyone, that the single most challenging thing to those of us trying to wake people up and inform people about what's actually happening in Iraq and what is U.S. policy, the single greatest obstacle at this point is a guy named Barack Obama, where so many people have drunk the Obama Kool-Aid and they wore their T-shirts in November and he was elected and they feel like, hey, that's it. It's all good now, right? You know, he's pulling out of Iraq, and it's going to take some time, and sure, it's a little bit complicated, but no, things are getting better there, right? Or we won, quote-unquote, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it could not be further from the truth. I mean, we're still looking at anywhere between a dozen and 100 Iraqis being killed every day. Attacks on U.S. troops there continue. The infrastructure is far worse now than it was even a couple of years ago. That's even possible seems pretty amazing. And it's extremely unstable politically, and I think it's probably just a matter of time before we have another huge explosion. And, you know, unfortunately, what it takes for people to really pay attention over there is when more and more U.S. troops are being killed. But unfortunately, that's probably what's going to happen, of course, not even talking about Afghanistan.
Well, talk about the surge that began in January of 2007, I believe.
Yes.
And about how the Republicans and the neoconservatives, who still, of course, are in Obama's administration, how they term that a success. what was really the cost of that so-called success, and why do they even think it's a success?
Well, you know, it's amazing. It's been another amazing propaganda campaign and a successful one, the whole so-called surge, because the reality is that what really caused the dramatic decrease in American deaths was the buying off of the resistance, where basically the U.S. instituted a program back in the middle of 2006, before they even started sending in these 30,000 additional troops, where they literally found corrupt tribal sheikhs and paid them off to get fighters under their control to stop attacking occupation forces. And it was relatively successful. So temporarily, the U.S. stood up this 100,000-strong Sunni militia, comprised mostly of former resistance fighters, paying them $300 a month in U.S. taxpayer money, and we saw a dramatic decline in U.S. deaths. But now it's really complicated the situation politically, because now we have these armed militiamen running around, and they're not being incorporated into the government forces as was promised. And so we're looking at a tinderbox politically, where these guys want political power. What's going to happen in the upcoming January elections, which are not far off now, if these guys don't get the political power? Many of them are already talking about going right back into the resistance, and we know what that means.
Well, right. And also what you talked about earlier is the Balkanization of the country has basically, and I have not been to Iraq myself, but I've talked to Iraqis all over the world. I've been to Jordan meeting with them, and they basically say that neighborhoods that were very diverse are now just the opposite. They're all, like you said, you have to pass through checkpoints to get through each neighborhood, which had a result of, and let's just face it, Dar, over 1 million people are dead and 4 million people displaced, so the country's been decimated with population.
It has, and in addition to those figures, we can add another 8 million in need of emergency assistance and who are also living in abject poverty on less than a dollar a day, according to Oxfam International. I mean, the situation is not getting any better for the Iraqi people. It's really amazing how bad it got and then how it's continued to worsen, and yet, of course, you know, so many people, even so-called anti-war folks in this country, think, it's better or it's won. Actually, you know, you certainly can't tell that to people in Iraq just trying to survive at this point on a daily basis.
Well, and it's heartbreaking, and the tragedy is that many of the large anti-war movements were co-opted by the Democratic Party. And I just get so frustrated because, like you, I haven't stopped my activism. I haven't stopped working. You know, the war is wrong no matter who's president. But it's really frustrating because these same people who supported Obama, even though his Iraq plan was unsatisfactory, and even though he promised to send more troops to Afghanistan, he promised to do this cross-border bombing into the tribal regions of Pakistan, they supported him, they raised money for him, they worked for him, they voted for him, they had their followers vote for him, and now they write a petition to him to stop it.
Right, and as we know, that it's going to take a lot more than signing your name on a petition or wearing a T-shirt or even at this point walking in a street on a weekend, that it's, you know, really the only thing that this administration or any other administration is going to understand is when it becomes politically unviable for them to continue forward with the policies that they're engaged in. And it's up to us to show them, look, not only do we disagree with this, but we will be your political death if you continue on with this policy, that you literally won't be able to stay in power and have any kind of a base whatsoever if you continue forward with this U.S. empire policy. And so that's what it's going to take. It's going to take real mobilization and real sacrifice and really people throwing their bodies on the front lines to make this stop, not just signing a petition or not just trying to ask Nancy Pelosi, please. But you know, clearly these people will only listen to things when their personal stake, i.e. their own
right.
political power and their own political future, is at stake. And again, if we aren't pushing them up against that wall, then, you know, to think that anything's just going to change is, you know, we might as well just go to Disneyland.
Well, you know, we're on the subject. We just have like a minute before we have to take the break. What do you think about, you know, these people who support Obama and they don't make any demands on him or political demands? They say, well, at least he's better than McCain. What do you think about the, you know, the foreign policy choices Obama's made compared to what would McCain have done anything differently?
Yeah, I think that that's, you know, a nice rationalization for political sloth, for people to say, well, you know, Obama's, at least he's better than, so, you know, insert, you know, name of idiot here, whether it be McCain or Sarah Palin or George Bush. Because the reality, when we look at the hard facts, which are the National Security Strategy of the United States and the Quadrennial Defense Review Report, these are the exact same reports running U.S. policy now as we had under George Bush. These policies have literally not changed. They haven't been updated, nor were they supposed to be. And in fact, of course, we've maintained Bush's Secretary of Defense and Robert Gates, and as you noted, you know, most of the leading hawks and advisors from Clinton's time, as well as some that were hung over from George W. Bush. So we've had literally no policy change whatsoever. Instead, all we have is, you know, a charismatic, articulate, intelligent person as president, as opposed to a bumbling buffoon. But that's the only thing that's really changed. When we look at the hard policies on the ground, we've seen just nothing more but a continuation of George Bush's administration. We are really in George Bush's third term if we're going to get down to the brass tacks.
Well, absolutely. And today, too, they just extended the national emergency from September 11th, 2001. So that's just another awesome extension of the Bush disease. But anyway, Dar, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about your book. It's a subject that is so important to me, and the book is The Will to Resist. Stay tuned to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. You're listening to my interview with Dar Jamail. We'll be right back.
My name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you are listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Cindy Sheehan's new booklet, Myth America, examines two distinct groups of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims, such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet. Those who send their children off to die in robber class wars. Those who lack proper health care. Those who are denied decent education. And those who lose their jobs and homes and become homeless. Myth America exposes America's robber class, which controls our government, and affirms that we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. To obtain a copy of Myth America and learn how we can take back our country, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. We're talking to Dar Jamail, who is right around Houston, and I'm in Louisville, Kentucky. Dar, tell my listeners about your book, The Will to Resist. I support soldiers who refuse to go to these illegal and moral wars. I support them financially. I support them morally. My son didn't want to go, but he thought it was his duty, so he went. He was killed hours after he actually got to post. But the thing I support about these men and women is, you know, they realize that they're being used as tools of the U.S. empire, and they don't want to die, and they don't want to kill anybody as tools. So tell my listeners about your book.
Well, and that is really the spirit of the book, is it's about people in the military, most of which are Iraq and or Afghanistan veterans. Some of them are active duty folks, and it's about people that basically join the military for various reasons, whether it's for economic reasons or out of patriotism or wanting to serve their country, and then realize that by being in Iraq or Afghanistan, it literally pushes them up against a moral crisis where they realize, look, they're being asked to follow unlawful orders. And so many of them understand that, for example, not only the situation in Iraq, but the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan violates the Geneva Conventions as well, which by definition, given that the U.S. is a signatory of the Geneva Conventions, violates the Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution,
right.
Which then by definition puts a soldier in a moral crisis where they have to decide, do I follow these orders, which are actually illegal by both domestic and international law, or do I stand up and refuse? And to do the moral thing as well as the lawful thing, these people realize, well, I'm going to have to take a stand and basically go up against and fight the U.S. military and be court-martialed and probably have to do some jail time. So I started running into people who were actually taking public stands against both occupations, as well as other different kinds of resistance, of which there's myriad types of resistance, whether it's from doing fake patrols in Iraq and Afghanistan or coming back home and becoming very outspoken and outspoken against it and having things like Winter Soldier events like Iraq Veterans Against the War sponsored. So really I started running into all these different types of resistance that veterans and active duty folks were involved in and realized, wow, there's more than enough material here to actually write a book.
And so probably most of my listeners know what Winter Soldier is. My listeners are very smart, and they're very well informed. But for maybe a few that wouldn't know what Winter Soldier was, can you explain to my listeners what that was?
Winter Soldier was a phenomena that began during Vietnam when, similarly, soldiers were coming back from Vietnam and realizing that most of the people in this country were not getting any real clear information about how bad it really was over there and what was actually happening. So, similarly, a bunch of Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans associated with Iraq Veterans Against the War came back and held a big conference in Silver Spring, Maryland. It was spring a year ago. And about 56 or so of them testified on different panels about what they did in Iraq, what they saw over there, and showed photos and showed videos and really gave us a clear picture about what it was and the atrocities they were carrying out and how horrible the situation really was. It was a really shocking conference to be a part of and be there, and it was very, very difficult weekend, but a very necessary one. And so it was all over the alternative media, of course, Pacifica outlets, some satellite stations, Democracy Now!, et cetera, Laura Flanders Show. But, of course, no big shocker, corporate media, in large part in this country, basically censored it.
And that's really unfortunate because pretty much the people that watch Democracy Now! Or listen to Laura Flanders, we know what's going on over there. It's mainstream America that needs to get the message. And I think that's one of the reasons my protest was so successful because, you know, mainstream media did cover it. And people here in Kentucky, for example, got to see the face of somebody who had been fundamentally harmed by the policies of the Bush administration in Iraq. But do you feel comfortable about sharing some of the stories that you wrote about?
Well, absolutely. There's so many stories in the book that are really, really inspiring when we talk about soldiers who are standing up. I mean, we had, back in 2006, we had Aaron Matata, who at the time was, as a first lieutenant, was the highest-ranking non-commissioned officer to publicly refuse a combat deployment to Iraq based on what I talked about earlier about the fact that it violates international and domestic law, and it was his moral obligation as a soldier to refuse this illegal order. And, you know, him taking a public stand and the military trying to throw the book at him, him being court-martialed, the military judge blowing the trial, through his own incompetence, and then basically letting Ouattara sit behind a desk for several years until this May, when actually then the Justice Department dropped all the major charges against him. So at the end of the day, we have the highest-ranking officer to have publicly refused a combat deployment will not spend one day in Iraq nor one day in jail. So it sends a very clear message to anyone who's considering standing up against both these occupations and resisting a direct order to deploy that there is a future of GI resistance. You're becoming part of a growing number of people, a rather large number of people who are on a daily basis increasingly disobeying these direct orders to deploy. And we, while we have a fragmented movement that really lacks overall organization or leadership, we still have some very, very large numbers. I mean, we can look at hard Pentagon numbers that show us that on average between 5 and 12,000 people are going absent without leave every single year, and that number is increasing dramatically right now.
Well, this might be a good time to talk about Afghanistan because Afghanistan clearly is an illegal and immoral war, but many people in this country believe that it's a just war. However, for the first time, we've seen the numbers of Americans polled 57% the last time I saw think that Afghanistan's not worth fighting anymore. I think our troops should start coming home. Was it true? I've met Aaron's mom and dad and his stepmother. I've never had a chance to meet with Aaron. Did he believe that Afghanistan was a just war? Was he willing to be deployed to Afghanistan?
At the time, he did. Granted, remember, this is back in 2006 where it wasn't as clear what was going on in Afghanistan as far as U.S. policy, and I haven't had a chance to speak with Aaron more recently to see if his mind had changed, because even back at that time, overall, as an organization, for example, Iraq Veterans Against the War would not stand up and say, well, no, we're actually opposed to Afghanistan as well, because that violates international law and domestic law. But since then, Iraq Veterans Against the War relatively recently has also amended their mission statement to include not just opposition to the Iraq occupation, but also that in Afghanistan. So I would imagine that he would probably, Aaron Ouattara, I won't put words in his mouth, but I'd be pretty surprised if he wouldn't have amended his position to reflect that as well, because the exact same reasons he articulated for not deploying to Iraq, citing the U.S. Constitution, citing international law, citing the Uniform Code of Military Justice, all of that applies just as much exactly to Afghanistan. And the reality is that, just because the corporate media holds the loudspeaker and can blare this propaganda about what's a patriot and what's an obedient soldier and all this kind of nonsense, that does not change international law. That does not change the U.S. Constitution, both of which are firmly on our side, those of us who are writing about and advocating that, look, people in the military who resist both these occupations are actually being truly patriotic and really adhering to the oath they swore to as a soldier, which is to defend and protect the Constitution, but only by following lawful orders.
And it's actually a very, I would say, uber courageous thing to do, especially some of the soldiers that have done it in the battlefield. Did you interview anybody or tell a story of somebody who became a conscientious objector while in Iraq?
Well, Augustine Aguayo is a fine example of someone who filed for conscientious objector status, but was got deployed to Iraq anyhow. And so this is a guy who felt so strongly in his beliefs that he was opposed to all war and all violence, even though he was in the military, that he literally spent several months in Iraq going into a very volatile area of Sadr City, Baghdad, going out on patrols on almost a daily basis and never had a loaded weapon. And then when his deployment ended, he was in a base in Germany and then managed to escape from the base so as not to be deployed again. So this is someone clearly fully dedicated as a conscientious objector, and there's been many, many others since then. Even very, very recently, we have Sergeant Travis Bishop, whose court-martial I recently attended up in Fort Hood, Texas, who also had served a tour in Iraq and then came back and filed for conscientious objector status and now is literally doing a year in a military brig for standing up for what he believed in. But according to his recent statements from jail, saying, I have no regrets whatsoever. I'm sleeping with a clear conscience at night.
Well, we just have like a couple minutes left, but I don't know if you know the story, Dar, but about a year and a half ago, I was contacted by one of Casey's buddies, and Casey was killed in Sauter City. But there's this lie the military told us that Casey volunteered to go on the mission, you know, that Casey then, and there's like even like these things that Casey supposedly said. And Martha Raddatz wrote a book that spread the propaganda of Casey's death. But his buddy emailed me and said, Cindy, why do you keep telling everybody your son volunteered? Casey did not volunteer. When he was ordered to go on the mission, he said, I'm not going. I'm just a mechanic. And his sergeant literally dragged him on the truck and forced him to go on the mission, and he was killed minutes later. And I've always been proud of my son, but after I heard that, I was so proud of him to be in a combat zone and to refuse an illegal order.
Right, and that's what has to happen, you know, and it's you know, you should be proud of him, and you know, any of his, he's setting an example for anyone around him and all soldiers that, you know, you are duty-bound as a soldier never to follow an illegal order. And, you know, both of these illegal occupations are built on a bedrock of, or not a bedrock, of basically a corrupt base of illegality and immorality. And so any soldier partaking in them is therefore duty-bound to refuse these orders. And you know, I think, you know, the example that Casey set and the example that so many of these people in my recent book are setting, I think really is building a new bedrock upon which hopefully, with a lot of work on our end, a new modern-day GI resistance movement might be formed. Because at this point, I feel like until soldiers en masse start really laying down their arms and saying, no, I'm not going to participate in this, we really don't have much of a chance of stopping this. But I think there is a lot of potential for having something like this phenomena start to occur today.
Well, and then people also need to know about and have examples, like you said, because Casey didn't want to go. He went anyway. We didn't have anywhere to turn to. So there are organizations like Courage to Resist that help people resist. We, first of all, would be great if we could stop our young people from even going into the military. So it's up to peace people to do counter-recruitment, to offer our young people alternatives to going into the military. And unfortunately, the military is over-recruited these days because there's no jobs. College is too expensive. So it's a very bad cycle we find ourselves in.
It's true, because we are in the midst of a poverty draft, and we are up against that. But as citizens, and as Aaron Matata laid out in his speech at the VFP National Convention in Seattle in 06, that, you know, if civilians can gather around and find these people who are going to resist and reassure them that they would have their families back, especially economically, if they go and are in jail for a while, for following their conscience and standing up, then we really would have the groundwork laid for a GI resistance movement. And this is a very possible thing to do. It just takes a little organization.
Yeah, we need to support them, you know, with not just saying we support you, but financially also as a movement. Dar, we're unfortunately out of time. Your new book is The Will to Resist. Can you let my listeners know how they can get a hold of you?
Sure, I have a website. It's simply dar.org, dahr.org. And thanks so much for having me on, Cindy. It's always a pleasure and honor to talk with you.
Well, thank you for your work. Thank you for your book. And I hope it's a big success, because that means it will save lives. That was my friend, Dar DeMail. When we come back, we'll be talking to Sheila Dean. You're listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. This is your host, Cindy Sheehan. Stay tuned.
Cindy Sheehan's new booklet, Myth America, examines two distinct groups of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims, such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet, those who send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose their jobs and homes and become homeless. Myth America exposes America's robber class, which controls our government, and affirms that we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. To obtain a copy of Myth America and learn how we can take back our country, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you are listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. You're listening at CindySheehansSoapbox.com and Rational Radio, 1360 AM, Dallas, Texas. My next guest is Sheila Dean, and she's from BeatTheChip.org, and I'll let Sheila tell you about that. Sheila, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Hi, Cindy.
Hi, thanks for being on today.
Thank you.
Where are you today in the world?
Well, today is a pretty rainy day, but it doesn't mean that there isn't a lot to do to stop things from getting darker.
Right. So
I try to stay positive.
I told my listeners that your website is beatthechip.org. Now, please tell my listeners what your activism is centered around.
Well, what we do is we are media activists who report exclusively on the national identity issue. And why the national identity issue is important is because it affects everybody. And there are some very troubling things about Real ID and the upcoming Pass ID Act that would injure people's privacy.
Well, first of all, tell my listeners quickly what the Real ID Act is.
The Real ID Act was passed kind of like a Trojan horse in a supplemental war funding bill, and for tsunami relief. And
right.
From that, we got a national identity card program that would cover the entire United States and try to make it an international passport card between the U.S. and Mexican border and the Canadian border. And ordinarily, no one would think that that's a big deal, but it's you wanted to go into another country, you simply could get a passport. So it's not necessary to kind of develop a national ID card. So that was kind of fishy. When you look into it further, there's a lot of technologies that are very wasteful spending and that would cause citizens to lose their privacy because the technologies expose you to identity theft and also put you in a place to be surveilled by the government at all times based on transactional information.
So what do you mean by transactional information if it's an ID?
Well, what they have is they have a couple of things. They've got your biometric attributes from your face, maybe your fingerprints that are in a national to international database. They're trying to adjust the regulations for this now in the PASS Act. But the PASS Act keeps the majority of Real ID in place, so it's not that great. So it also has this thing called a radio frequency ID chip, which stores transactional information wherever you go. It interacts with different reading machines wherever you are, and so it will interact and leave a signal tag based on a location, almost like a GPS system, but it stores a copy of this in the chip. Also, the chip acts as a storage device for things like up to, I guess, maybe 1 gigabit of information. So it can store your social security number, everything that would be on an identity card, and more sensitive information about you.
Well, my my driver's license, I'm California, I have a California driver's license. It expired this year, and I got a new driver's license. Is all this stuff in my driver's license?
The California driver's license does not have all of those things. The states are in different places because each state has to uniquely adopt the regulations from the federal level in order to move forward, and each state has had to make a decision whether or not they're going to accept the Real ID. This year, 25 states passed some form of legislation signed by a governor rejecting the Real ID Act based on privacy, identity problems, and some of the cost to institute these advanced databases and the technologies are very expensive, and they haven't proven that they're going to be very much more secure.
Well, it doesn't seem like they're going to be any more secure than the driver's licenses we have right now. What would the government use this information for if the Real ID chip was placed in our IDs?
It's arbitrary. It's not. I think they might sell it. I would say that I'm not 100% clear on what they would do with it because they don't necessarily have all that information aggregated. But there are public-private partnerships and a lot of money to be made from the pork interests. So our chief criticism of this going on is that it's more of a disaster capitalism move. And everything's done on the auspices of 9/11 and the 9/11
right.
Commission report.
I just also had to apply for a new passport. Is there, and then also a passport card. What does that mean anything? Is there anything new in my passport I should be aware of? I read somewhere that when I get my new passport, I should beat it all over with a hammer.
That's something I've suggested that people do because it has that RFID chip in it.
So if I take it to customs when I'm trying to get back in the country and they can't read the RFID chip, is that something that's going to cause me problems?
I don't think it should because my personal passport is still good. If I were to take a passport to the airport, I use it as identification to fly.
Right.
Instead of an ID card.
Have you gotten your passport since the Real ID Act was passed?
No. I'm especially sensitive to identity. So I got my passport after George Bush was elected for the second time.
Uh-huh.
It was the first thing I did.
Uh-huh. So it wouldn't have had the RFID chip in it?
Well, I wasn't even aware of RFID.
My passport was 10 years old, so it expired. Yeah. I had to get a new passport. I don't think that it had anything like that in it. But, of course, it has the bar on it that they read and scan so they know when you left the country and when you're coming back into the country. But the RFID chip, from what I understand, are in the new passport.
Yeah, they've been in the passport since 2006.
And what kind of information does that give to the government that I don't want them to know? I have a problem even taking my shoes off when I go through airport security, which I do a lot because I think it's just another police state measure of intimidation. But what do these RFID chips we just have a couple minutes left. Tell my listeners what the problem is with them, what you all think the problem is with them.
They're very insecure. Identity theft can happen. And if you have sensitive information on that chip, like your address, your social security number, your whereabouts, are all part of the information gathered by that chip when it comes into contact with a radio frequency ID reader, which could be a UPC gun.
Right,
and so it keeps a little record of wherever you've been, and so it's more like a surveillance device. If someone can tap into something and basically track where you've been and kind of watch you from behind the scenes by tagging or hacking into your chip. But they can also get sensitive information about you. The government wants way more control, and by having this amount of information, it puts a real bit in your mouth. I hate to use that analogy, but it's like someone taking a small thing about you and saying, I know where you are. I know what you're doing. I'm watching you every move that you make. And that's just not necessary. That isn't freedom.
Well, it's Big Brother, and it definitely isn't freedom. I just am in my apartment building I live in San Francisco. They just installed an electronic key fob. And so to get in the front door, we have to put our key fob in front of the reader, and then it unlocks the door. And we just found out that key fob can also be read by the San Francisco Police Department. So the San Francisco Police Department knows where you are 100% of the time.
Yeah. There are things that you can buy that will prohibit you from, you know, allowing that any kind of, like, technology to be read by other machines. That's pretty much what you can do. I'm working with people right now who want to endorse what we're doing on beatthechip.org by sponsoring us with sleeves to kind of protect, you know, unwanted information from going out and coming in through cards.
Is that kind of information on your website, beatthechip.org?
If someone wants to email me, I'll give you specific information about that. But most of the information usually is available in some shape or form on beatthechip.org.
Okay, so my listeners can go to beatthechip.org to get more info and to contact you, Sheila?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox today. We really appreciate it. Sheila Dean from beatthechip.org with some great information for us. Stay tuned. When we come back, we'll be listening to a listener's rant.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
My Ask Cindy question today comes from Tom Hendricks in Toledo, Ohio. It's not really a question, it's just a statement that I agreed with 100%. Dear Ms. Sheehan, thank you for continuing to be against war regardless of who is in the White House. Now that the Democrats have control of things, I'm afraid that, just as in the days of the Johnson administration, they like war just as Nixon and Bush did. Tom Hendricks from Toledo, Ohio. Well, Tom, we talked earlier with Dar just about how bad things really are and how things are not improving under a Democratic administration. As a matter of fact, they're getting worse. So please, we need to really get out on the streets. We need to make our presence known that we are against war. If Republicans can shut down town hall meetings about health care and change policy towards health care reform in this country, then why can't we on the left change policies towards these wars that we've always been against? Today, my rant is going to be replaced by a listener rant from John Perry. So listen to what John Perry has to say.
By now, you've certainly heard about and many of you have seen the final photograph of Marine Lance Corporal Joshua Bernard, taken by an embedded Associated Press reporter immediately after he was mortally wounded and shortly before he died in Afghanistan. It's a very graphic example of the realities of combat. But there was no need to publish it. A brief, accurate description of the event without the photo would have been more than enough. Lower legs blown off by a rocket-propelled grenade. Lance Corporal Bernard died a short time later on the operating table. No photo necessary. Let's make something perfectly clear. I'm not here to defend the Associated Press. They're part of a news media that has failed America miserably and continues to fail America miserably. But everybody denouncing the publication of this photograph needs to remember a very important point. Joshua Bernard is not dead because somebody took his picture. He's dead because his commander-in-chief sent him to take part in an illegal war of aggression against a country that poses no threat to the United States, a needless, immoral, indefensible attack that is accomplishing nothing except killing scores of innocent civilians, destroying their country, killing a rapidly growing number of our own soldiers, enriching war profiteers on our dime while we, the people, go bankrupt here at home. An exponential growth in the number of people around the world who hate and want to kill Americans. As Paul Craig Roberts writes in an article published this week, for the American War Secretary, it is a photo that is insensitive, not America's assertion of the right to determine the fate of Afghanistan with bombs and soldiers. The exceptional, virtuous nation does not think it is insensitive for America's bombs to blow innocent villagers to pieces. Roberts refers specifically to the U.S. NATO airstrike on two hijacked tanker trucks, which happened last week, the day before Gates came out denouncing the AP photograph of Lance Corporal Bernard. Many villagers had gathered around these trucks to try and gather the fuel they were carrying. At least 70 of these villagers were instantly incinerated when the airstrike hit. Roberts quotes one of the villagers who was there. Nobody was in one piece. Hands, legs, and body parts were scattered everywhere. Those who were away from the fuel tanker were badly burnt. Again, no photo necessary. Some will continue to avert their eyes. Others will continue to turn their head completely. Still others will continue to occupy themselves with convenient distractions, like mindless entertainment, or the naked propaganda of their talking head heroes on television and radio, or personal attacks on the messengers of truth, and the incessantly juvenile claims about how our motivation is all just politics. But nobody will ever be able to escape the ugly truth, which is that for as long as we illegally occupy and destroy lands that do not belong to us, killing innocent people who mean no harm to us, we stand no chance of regaining the moral high ground and once again becoming a virtuous nation.
Well, that's it for Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I hope you enjoyed the show. In closing, I'd like to thank my guests, Darja Mayo and Sheila Dean. I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my assistant producer, Mikey, and you for listening. And as always, I'd like to thank 1360 Rational Radio, Dallas, Texas. I hope you come back next week and listen to our next exciting show.
I must make my witness. Have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be.